eKatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of eKatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive.
Sure.
I am genuinely excited about today's material.
Mm-hmm.
We're diving into a book that really asks us to, well, toss out a very comfortable idea about modern America.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that the 1990s were, you know, peaceful, prosperous,
mm-hmm.
maybe even a bit boring.
Yeah, that whole holiday from history myth, it's sticky, isn't it? But John Gans's book, When the Clock Broke, Con Men, Conspiracists, and How America Cracked Up in the Early 1990s, just completely takes a sledgehammer to it.
Okay.
He argues, and it's pretty compelling, that the political chaos, the polarization, the kind of conspiratorial thinking we're swimming in today.
That stuff that feels so current.
Exactly. The DNA for all that. It was basically fully formed right then.
Right.
Between 1990 and 1994.
Okay. So let's unpack that. Our mission today, then, is to figure out how that happened. How did the U.S. go from that post-war consensus,
mm-hmm.
which wasn't perfect, obviously,
mm-hmm.
to this fractured kind of anti-institution landscape we see now? Gans is saying the early 90s wasn't the end of history. It was when the clock actually broke.
And to trace those fractures, it helps to know who our guide is, John Gans. He's a contemporary journalist, essayist, cultural critic. You might know his Substack, Unpopular Front.
Right, where he digs into extremism and political history.
Yeah. And what's interesting about him, what makes his perspective different, is he's not your traditional academic historian, you know, buried in archives.
Okay, so how does he approach it then?
Well, his background is more in political journalism. So he has this unique radar, I think, for the fringier stuff, the cultural moments that maybe got ignored at the time.
Ah, so he connects the dots differently.
Precisely. He kind of merges that journalistic nose for the weird stuff with real academic depth. He links these obscure political movements, figures people dismissed as like sideshows,
yeah.
directly to the big cultural and political trends that eventually took over. He calls himself a political archaeologist.
I like that. Political archaeologist. It suggests digging beneath the surface, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Finding the origins.
Totally. He's not just listing events. He's tracing the lineage, the ideas, the rhetoric of today's turmoil back to its roots, showing that, you know, the chaos now wasn't spontaneous. It was, in a way, engineered back then.
Okay, so where does he start the digging? What's the core argument of When the Clock Broke?
Well, it actually starts with something most people saw as a massive win, the end of the Cold War.
Wait, the triumph? How is that the start of the problem? That seems backwards.
Because for almost 50 years, American identity, its purpose, its whole political structure was defined by this simple conflict, communism versus capitalism, us versus them.
Right.
When the Soviet Union collapsed, poof, that whole framework just vanished, and it left behind this huge ideological vacuum. That's the broken clock moment.
Right. So the establishment figures, the end of history, people like Fukuyama, they looked around, saw victory, and assumed stability. Exactly. They got complacent. They thought, we won. Job done.
But they completely failed to offer a new vision, something compelling for the country, or even to really address the anxieties people were feeling about globalization, cultural shifts, all that stuff.
And nature, or maybe history, abhors a vacuum.
Right. It certainly does. And Gantz shows that this void, this lack of direction from the center, it got filled quickly.
By
populist demagogues, conspiracists, media provocateurs, people operating on the fringes who pioneered a totally new political style.
What defined that style?
Oh, it's all about anti-establishment rage, deep distrust of institutions, a focus on ethno-nationalism, and this undercurrent of paranoia about, you know, a new world order or unseen global elites pulling the strings.
So the book is basically the prequel to now. It's arguing the real crisis wasn't just about policy fights, but something deeper, like how we even decide what's true.
That's it, exactly. Gans calls it an epistemological crisis, a crisis in knowledge itself, the shift from arguing about what to do to arguing about what is real. And to see that shift happening, he looks at these key kind of laboratories where this new politics was being tested and refined.
Let's get into those. Where do we start? The political lab.
Yeah, let's start there. Pat Buchanan's 1992 primary challenge against George H.W. Bush. Gans sees Buchanan not just as some failed candidate.
Which he was, technically.
Technically, yes. But Gans sees him as a prophet, a preview of the politics to come.
Why Buchanan? What was he doing that was so new?
He was the first guy to really successfully fuse economic anxiety, you know, Worries about globalization, jobs going overseas with deep cultural grievances.
So taking two things that maybe weren't always linked politically.
Right, and weaving them together. Yeah. He basically created the template for America First nationalism.
How did he do that? Can you give an example?
Sure. So he wouldn't just complain about NAFTA sending jobs away, which was a real economic concern for lots of people. He'd link that economic betrayal, losing the factory job, to a cultural betrayal. He'd argued that these globalist elites, these liberals in the cities, were deliberately trying to tear down traditional American values, Christian values.
Ah, so it turns losing your job into part of a bigger, almost spiritual battle, like his culture war speech in 92.
That speech was absolutely foundational. Declaring this war for the soul of America, it really set the tone for so much of the modern right.
And how did the mainstream react? Gantz talks about that, right?
He does. And he's pretty critical of George H.W. Bush.
Yeah.
She seemed completely out of touch, like a patrician who couldn't grasp this raw anger.
In Clinton.
Bill Clinton, yeah.
Yeah.
Brilliant politician, but he offered what Gantz calls technocratic centrism.
Okay, technocratic centrism.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean in practice? And why wasn't it enough?
It means trying to solve problems with data, policy papers, managerial skill. You know, balance the budget, tweak welfare based on studies. It speaks to the head.
Logical.
But the anxieties Buchanan was tapping into, they were emotional, cultural, spiritual even. They spoke to the gut. Clinton offered competence. Buchanan offered meaning.
And meaning often wins, especially when people feel lost.
Especially in that ideological vacuum we talked about. Competence doesn't fill a void like that.
Okay, so you have the political grievance stirred up by Buchanan.
Yeah.
But you need something.
Right.
To make people feel the threat is real.
Exactly. Which brings us to these tragic events that became, well, foundational myths for the paranoia style. Ruby Ridge and Waco.
The paranoia machine, as Gantz puts it.
Yeah, and these are such crucial case studies.
Yeah.
Because Gantz argues they weren't just law enforcement screw-ups, though they certainly involved that.
Right.
They were huge cultural moments. They directly fed the anger and paranoia of the growing anti-government militia movement.
Ruby Ridge in 92, the Weaver family standoff,
mm-hmm.
and Waco in 93, the Branch Davidian siege. What was the impact?
For these movements, the government's actions, which were seen as heavy-handed, sometimes incompetent, they became martyr stories. Tangible, bloody proof. Proof that the tyrannical federal government, the New World Order, that conspiracy theorists had been warning about, it was real. It was armed. And it was coming for them.
It gave all that abstract paranoia a very concrete visual focus.
Yeah.
Undeniable evidence in their eyes.
Absolutely. It gave the whole worldview a massive jolt of psychological validity.
So the paranoia gets validated. How does it spread? How does it reach more people? That needs a different kind of engine, right?
Right. You need a new media ecosystem. And that's where figures like Rush Limbaugh and, in a different way, David Duke come in.
Talk radio. Its impact seems almost impossible to overstate looking back.
Oh, it was revolutionary. Rush Limbaugh basically created this huge alternative media universe, mm-hmm. completely separate from the mainstream gatekeepers, the big newspapers, the network news.
He went straight to the listener.
Directly. Mm-hmm. No filter. And he wasn't just reporting news. He was validating grievances, amplifying anger, telling listeners they weren't crazy for feeling suspicious.
It sounds a lot like how social media echo chambers work now, doesn't it?
It's the direct ancestor. He built this incredibly powerful community, this shared identity, all forged through suspicion of the mainstream and validation of their own resentments. It was a business model, too.
And a powerful political force. What about David Duke? How does he fit into this new ecosystem?
Duke's campaigns, Gantz argues, showed something else. How to mainstream extremism.
Duke, the former KKK Grand Wizard. How do you mainstream that?
By sanitizing the language. That was the key. He didn't run openly on, you know, raw racial hate anymore. He learned to cloak it.
How so?
He'd talk about welfare reform as a coded way to attack minorities. He'd demand equal rights for whites, to frame white people as victims. It was about making the ideology sound respectable, populist even.
Finding language that could slip past the usual defenses. Incremental normalization.
Exactly. He showed there was a path for these really extreme ideas to get a hearing in mainstream politics just by changing the wrapping paper. Small compromises in language making bigger shifts possible later.
It really does feel like a decoder ring for so much of what came later. Okay, let's pull back a bit. What are the big overarching themes Gantz is hitting on, the structural psychological stuff?
Well, first is that end of history vacuum we keep coming back to. It wasn't just political, it was like existential.
Really?
When the big enemy disappears, People get anxious. They need new explanations for why things feel wrong. They need new enemies sometimes. And this search made the country really vulnerable to simplistic answers, to conspiracy theories that offered a clear us versus them again.
Okay, so that's the psychological vulnerability. Then there's the technology piece.
Yeah, what Gans calls the democratization of authority and deception.
Yeah. Double-edged sword.
Totally. Technology, talk radio, then the early internet, like bulletin boards and stuff, it smashed the monopoly the old gatekeepers had on information, on truth.
Which sounds good, right? More voices.
In theory, yes. Good for free speech. But it was also disastrous for having any kind of shared reality. It meant misinformation, extremist ideas could spread like wildfire with no real institutional checks or filters.
The immune system was gone.
Pretty much. And Gans is always careful to connect this back to people's real lives, especially their economic lives.
Right. The economic anxiety wasn't just invented.
No, it was real. The early 90s had globalization hitting hard, recession, real dislocation. But that legitimate anger about jobs, about wages stagnating.
It got hijacked.
It got channeled away from, say, actual policy debates about trade or economic support and towards scapegoating. Blame immigrants, blame global elites, blame the New World Order. It's a classic move, right? Use economic pain to fuel cultural warfare.
And that ties into the last big theme, the appeal of the paranoia itself.
Yeah, paranoia as community. Conspiracy theories aren't just explanations. They fulfill a deep psychological need.
How so?
They make you feel smart, special, in the know.
Yeah.
You possess secret knowledge the sheeple don't have. It elevates you. And it connects you to this community of other enlightened people. That sense of belonging can be incredibly powerful, much stronger than just, you know, voting for a party.
That makes a scary amount of sense. The book also has some really punchy lines that stick with you. What's one that captures that whole ideological void idea?
I think it's the sentiment, maybe not a direct quote, but the core idea. The end of the Cold War didn't bring peace to America. It brought a crisis of meaning that made the country vulnerable to every charlatan and conspiracy theorist. It just flips the whole triumph narrative on its head.
Yeah, it really does. And for that breakdown in truth itself,
this one captures it. In the early 1990s, America didn't just change its politics, it changed its relationship to truth itself. That hits right at the epistemological crisis. It wasn't just disagreement. It was reality itself becoming debatable.
Chilling. And the technology angle?
This sums it up perfectly. Technology democratized authority, but it also democratized deception. That's the paradox we're still wrestling with every single day online, isn't it?
Absolutely. So understanding this history isn't just academic. It feels incredibly relevant for, like, navigating today.
It really is a decoder ring, like you said earlier. Once you grasp Buchanan's 92 playbook.
Yeah.
You hear those same talking points constantly now. The way cultural grievances get fused with attacks on globalist elites, on trade deals. The script hasn't changed that much. It helps you see the patterns.
And the lessons from Rush Limbaugh back then, they map directly onto understanding social media now, right? How these platforms create bubbles.
Totally. How they're designed often to reinforce identity through shared anger or suspicion. Understanding the 90s helps you ask that critical question today. Whose interests are served by making me feel this way? Who benefits from my outrage?
That's a really useful question.
And there's a cautionary tale in there too, isn't there? About leadership.
Maybe.
Gans really shows that when the mainstream establishment gets complacent, when it fails to offer a compelling vision or address people's real anxieties, a vacuum is created. And if the center won't lead with imagination, the extremes will always rush in with simplistic, often dangerous answers.
That feels very relevant. What's the biggest surprise for you reading this, or the thing that really clicked?
For me, it was realizing how the economic boom of the late 90s didn't actually fix any of this. It didn't defeat these forces.
It just papered over them.
Exactly. It just sent them dormant for a while. They went underground, maybe got better organized online in the early days, and just waited for the next shock, 9/11, the 08 crash, whatever, to come roaring back.
That's unsettling. For me, I think it was the sheer speed of it all, how quickly the ground shifted between 90 and 94. It makes you realize the political earthquake of, say, 2016, it wasn't sudden.
Not at all.
It was a massive aftershock, the culmination of these fractures that happened decades earlier. The 90s weren't the end. They were this incredibly turbulent beginning.
The beginning we're still living through in many ways.
Which leads to that final, maybe provocative thought. Gans leaves us with something to really chew on.
Yeah, the idea that the normalization of extreme ideas, the way fringe stuff becomes mainstream, It rarely happens overnight.
It's incremental.
It's incremental normalization. It's a series of tiny compromises. Each little step makes the next, slightly more extreme idea seem a bit more acceptable, until suddenly, things that were completely unthinkable are just part of the regular political debate.
A crucial warning, maybe, for keeping our own guard up today.
Definitely something to keep in mind.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.